You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Carol Menke is one of just 222 people who live in Vernon.
There are 10 houses on Furlong. There are 6 houses on Fruitland. There are 8 units in an apartment building on 50th Street and 2 houses on Vernon.
That's Carol. She can list Vernon's entire housing stock off the top of her head. It's a 5-square-mile industrial city just south of downtown Los Angeles. And a new zoning change there is set to quintuple Vernon's population over the next several years. Reporter Jackson Cantrell has the story.
Vernon, California has the words exclusively industrial embossed on its city seal. Living here has its quirks.
You're likely to walk out in the middle of the street and get run over by a truck. And I mean an 18-wheeler, not a little truck.
Carol Menke was on the Vernon City Council between 2019 and 2021 and lives here on Furlong Place. It's a palm tree-lined cul-de-sac of exactly 10 one-story homes. Each has a small lawn and a front porch decorated with welcome mats or flags and potted plants. The street could be in any residential Southern California neighborhood, except that it's entirely surrounded by huge warehouses, factories, and the bare 3-story facade of the back of City Hall. Other parts of Vernon are home to rail yards, sprawling electrical substations, smokestacks, and slaughterhouses. During the day, you have to dodge semi-trucks to cross the street. When the 45,000 to 50,000 people who work here leave, you can practically do push-ups in an intersection. Another one of Vernon's quirks? It's politics. Yeah, elections can get testy anywhere, but when you're one of only several dozen likely voters, and you can see most of the candidates' homes from your porch, it's personal. Carol introduced me to her next-door neighbor, Dora Douglas. Carol and Dora are friends, but Dora says she doesn't hear from any other elected leaders.
You won my vote, but you never say hi to me. Only when you need my vote, that's when you want to talk to me. You never knock on my door just to see, hey, Dora, how are you doing? You know, how's it going?
For decades, politicians here didn't have to talk to a lot of people. The votes of just a handful of relatives and friends could secure elections. City leaders could then pay themselves high salaries and control lucrative city contracts without the fear of losing their jobs. And there's another twist. Not only did Vernon limit its housing, the city owns much of what housing there is. That can be useful if you want to bully electoral challengers. A 2006 LA Times investigation found that for years, Vernon officials evicted those who disagreed with them, including residents who tried to run against the mayor and council. Then, in 2011, after a former mayor of Vernon and his wife were convicted of voter fraud, the state of California threatened to dissolve the city. Fearing for its survival, Vernon adopted term limits and capped salaries for council members, and in 2015, opened a 45-unit housing development, which doubled the city's population from 100 to 200. In August, the city council passed a new zoning ordinance, which would allow for the construction of up to 874 additional units of housing. It also approved new uses like offices, art studios, and coffee shops. Under the ordinance, the city council won't directly be able to approve or deny a project. The changes went into effect on September 1st. Here's Vernon's mayor, Crystal Larios.
And as allowable use by right, it allows the city to focus on compliance with elements related to the building code, setback, zoning requirements, and it also removes the discretionary component from policymakers.
New apartments are already in the planning stages. Dan Wall, Vernon's director of public works, took me on a tour of the rezoned portion of South Santa Fe Avenue. It's about a mile south of LA's Arts District.
So this was a building that was recently purchased by a developer who would like to actually make this be primarily residential without changing the building very much.
Dan would like this part of Vernon to develop like the Arts District has. He points towards a 59,000-square-foot warehouse built in 1920 with Art Deco columns.
He has plans to put a roof deck on that flat portion of the building to provide amenities for future tenants.
That adaptive reuse is what architect Lorcan O'Herlihy thinks will help make this industrial part of Vernon into a livable neighborhood.
Why not work with the existing supply of buildings, reformulate them? And that's what's critical. It shows the DNA of a city. And I think that's what Vernon can be. You can embrace it.
O'Herlihy was hired to help draft Vernon's rezoning plan. He showed me maps that displayed a potential food hall in Public Square, street trees, and connections to transit nearby.
I always loved cities. I always loved piazzas. I love plazas. I love these type of gathering spaces that exist throughout cities.
Now, South Santa Fe Avenue, where most of the changes are set to take place, is a 5-lane truck route. Dan mentioned a future plan to convert the middle turn lane to street parking, but we're not going to see an Italian piazza there anytime soon. Still, when apartments are built, people will move in. Let's face it, LA needs housing.
Even if it's expensive, we cannot find anything.
That's Manny Liquidano. He owns Glass LA Design, a residential shower door and window supplier based in Vernon.
We do struggle with housing because the rents are very high and there is not enough single one-bedroom apartments or anything like that for workers.
Would you ever consider living here if they built housing?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, definitely. If it's close to my job, of course.
Even with new zoning and the threat of disincorporation gone, it'll still take time, creativity, and money to transform Vernon. When the dust settles, the 1,000 or so residents will go a long way to making the city feel like a normal place to live. For KCRW, I'm Jackson Cantrell.
More of Greater LA Now from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. When I say folk music, who do you think of? Joan Baez, Woody Guthrie, Lead Belly, Pete Seeger?
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land.
Probably don't think of LA as a hotbed for that kind of music, but maybe, just maybe, that'll change this weekend when the first annual L.A. Folk Festival takes off Saturday and Sunday over at the Ford Theater in Hollywood. That festival's the brainchild, by the way, of Kenneth Pattingale and Joey Ryan, both from Eagle Rock. And together, that duo sounds like this.
I am sitting in the midnight alone. Can't bring myself to pick up the phone. So I'm picking through a banjo tune I learned from you.
Joey and Kenneth, also known as the Milk Carton Kids, welcome to Greater LA.
Oh, thanks for having us, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Y'all are so professional.
Did you like that?
Yeah, that's like a super tight media intro.
Right, right. It looked pretty impressive, too, from the studio, didn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Why Milk Carton Kids? Why, I mean, did you go missing?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a little embarrassed to say we've named ourselves after one of our own lyrics,
okay.
Steve. Yeah.
How did that happen?
One of our early songs is called Milk Carton Kid, and as many of us remember, there was a phenomenon in like the 80s where we were putting missing kids on the backs of milk cartons, and it was this very specific sort of cultural reference that we grew up in LA in the 80s and 90s, and it just felt like a really strong generational identifier. And so in our song, we used it as kind of like a dark coming of age metaphor and named ourselves after it.
Do we still put pictures of children on milk cartons?
We don't. And you know, the whole phenomenon was only about 2 years long. It feels like it went on for 20 years, but the whole thing of milk carton kids on the milk carton was only a couple years. As far as I know, they never found any of those specific kids. And when we found out how short-lived and unsuccessful the campaign was, we were like, oh, we got to name ourselves after that.
Right. And but you're bucking that, right? You're successful.
I guess we've lasted longer.
You've lasted longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope those kids. Yeah, I mean, oh, that got really dark. My goodness,
you're focusing on the wrong thing, Steve.
No,
let me tell you, you're a born newsman.
It's true. It's true, and it's really sad.
Because really, all that happens is we get on an airplane, and the flight attendant goes, "What's your you have an instrument? What's
your
band?
Banjo.
Yeah, what's your band called?" And we go to the Milk Carton Kids, and they go, "Oh, how cute." They're not like, this is so sad. Did they ever find those missing children?
The name is really a Rorschach test for the listener.
Really, yeah.
What do you think of, Steve?
I should call my therapist right now. Yeah. Actually, I feel like I have some talking to do. What is folk music? How would you describe folk music? And you're both musicians. You both love, I mean, obviously you grew into this from children to adulthood. And did you think, I'm going to be a folk musician?
Well, it's not something you aspire to be. I guess there are some people that aspire to be.
But why wouldn't it be?
You're right. And there are some very famous examples of people aspiring to be a folk musician. Maybe the most famous, Bob Dylan, the amount of time that he spent emulating Woody Guthrie and trying to tap into that language and that mysticism was obviously as successful as it was, but was part of a great tradition. For us, as beautiful as your intro is, and I love this as a point of departure, I love the idea that the definition of folk music is not the capital F folk revival of the 60s that we all think about.
Joan Baez and...
Yeah, which is such a wealth of music that we draw on and we look to and we're inspired by. But that's not my folk music as much as, you know, like punk rock in the 80s in New York City was folk music. That's what was representing the voice of that generation. That's what was, the looking glass into the times and the people. And here in 2023 in LA, I think our festival, again, it's not so much supposed to tap into what history thinks of the definition of folk music, but more, who are the relevant voices? What's a little sliver of something vibrant that's happening that draws us in and draws us near?
I mean, you do understand, though, when somebody hears the words folk music, they're thinking of a specific thing.
Definitely. For real, and the first time we played the Newport Folk Festival, Jack White headlined, and he was a representation of that music and that community that year just as much as Bob Dylan and Leadbelly were in 1964. And I think there's something interesting culturally there.
How'd you get into folk music, Joey? And did you think about it as Joan Baez, Woody Guthrie, or or Bob Dylan, or did you think about it as Jack White?
I got into it for songwriting, the catharsis of songwriting. And so I think probably that tradition is a little more strongly rooted in like 70s singer-songwriter culture than like a folk revival from the 60s or anything like that. But then the allure and the sort of familiarity of acoustic instrumentation, which I think is the other thing that puts something squarely in the folk genre, I think that that comes maybe more from this tradition of Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan, et cetera. So, you know, I think of folk music as kind of acoustic instrumentation, but then a little bit of a outsider sort of, for lack of a better term, punk mentality. And I think there's a little bit something inherently subversive about doing acoustic music, minimalist music, stripped down sort of personal music in the middle of this modern landscape that we live in.
How'd y'all get together, by the way?
Joey and I separately were trying to have solo music careers. And I don't know who of us was doing better. That was the last time I was here at KCRW. I was recording a live session with Chris DeRitas on a Saturday that I ended up putting out as an album. But outside of that, which was probably the highlight of my solo career, it was mostly failed. As was Joey's, and we met in this great L.A. singer-songwriter community that was kind of, at that point, centered around the Hotel Cafe in Hollywood. But then Joey and I joined up, and things got a lot easier, and we realized how failed our solo careers actually were.
But whatever, right? That's all in the past. And yeah. And by the way, when you like sing something, put some words together, because y'all sound amazing, just your voices together. It's like they were made for each other. Like peanut butter and they chocolate, were. Right?
Swing low, for to carry me home in fire, the skies of red.
You see, I mean, they just go together, right?
Yeah, that's how we felt the first time
you
we
did?
Sang, yeah.
It was one totally. Of those sort of epiphany moments that actually a lot of harmony groups talk about, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash famously. The moment they sang together, light bulbs went off, and I, you know, it's how it was for us. We kind of, the first time that Kenneth invited me over to his house to sing together, and we just started right in on the first song, and it was like, oh, this is probably going to mess our lives up here because we're going to just have to do this and not much else.
And we did. The whole year was scheduled. Joey had a bunch of tours and I had a bunch of stuff, and we just mashed them together and joined each other for all the stuff we had arranged separately for a year until we could sort out our own little joint path, which has now been going for 12 long years.
Since the aughts.
Yeah, since the aughts. Through the teens.
What possessed you to put together a folk festival, though? Were you like, we want to get more people involved in this kind of music?
Well, folk festivals, maybe people don't know. Maybe we're a little too on the inside of this. But we travel around the country and the world playing at these great folk festivals in a lot of different places, including Newport Folk Festival, the Great Canadian Folk Festivals, Edmonton Folk Festival, Winnipeg Folk Festival, et cetera. And then over in England and throughout Europe, they have similar things. And so it's always the greatest time of the year, all summer, traveling around these places. And for the artists, it's like a big homecoming every time, right? Because we see all our friends backstage. We get to watch each other perform and catch up with this kind of group of misfits who we feel like are the only ones who really understand what it is to be a touring musician, especially a touring kind of folk musician on the fringes of the music industry. And so that sense of community has always drawn us to the festival circuit as artists. But then lately, especially since COVID, we've sort of really been put in mind of the idea that fans of folk music share a similar kinship with each other, and they travel to festivals sort of as a tradition. They'll have a couple or one or two that they go to every year. They know all the other fans that go there. They get to know some of the musicians. So there's just this beautiful sort of worldwide community of people who like this weird music. And we feel like LA is actually kind of a historic epicenter of folk music, and that we ought to have our own festival.
Historic epicenter.
I do.
LA is certainly a music town, and there are music labels here, right?
Yeah.
A lot of studios here and all of that, but you never hear it as a folk epicenter.
You don't. And that's
but
what
you just put that out there.
I did, yeah. And I think you could back it up historically, but you don't even need to, because in the modern day, just currently, the scene around venues like McCabe's and especially Largo, which is kind of our home base, I think is one of the most vibrant and collaborative music scenes in the country. And it's all kind of, I would classify it all as folk music, and also the way that it mixes with comedy, which is a great folk tradition, you know, of mixing the sort of acoustic music and comedy, going back to Greenwich Village, in New York in the 60s. So, I mean, LA obviously has the very famous Laurel Canyon music scene from the 60s and
the
70s.
Eagles, Frank Zappa.
Sure,
David
but Crosby,
Crosby,
Stills, and Nash,
right.
Joni Mitchell. And then Woody Guthrie's L.A. years are not to be underestimated in their influence they had on him and his music, and especially his political radicalization.
He came west,
and he maybe
and he
became a folk.
That's when he broadcasted,
yeah.
Right?
He was a radio man like
He's
you.
He's a radio man, yeah. So I am no Woody Guthrie. So.
I knew Woody Guthrie. I served with Woody Guthrie. You, Steve.
You, sir, are no Woody Guthrie. who are we going to see, by the way, at the Folk Festival this weekend?
Oh, man, we have literally, when we envisioned this festival, we wrote down a wish list of who would play the first year, and somehow they were all available and willing to come hang out. So throughout the weekend, it's Sierra Farrell, Waxahachie, Valerie June, Haley Hendricks, Trey Burt, Willie Watson, David Garza's putting together a really amazing program that he's calling Freaklorico.
And then us, the Milk Carton Kids, we did book ourselves
at our own festival.
Yeah, we did.
That's you will true. Perform.
We're not headlining, but we did. We set our sights higher than that.
You planning on doing this again, by the way?
Absolutely. Well, I meant to say this during one of your earlier questions, but it seems like maybe a funny idea to try to build community in Southern California, especially in music and something as quaint as folk music or seemingly as personal and small, to try to do that in a place that has 30 million people sort of fighting for freeway space and
not
aerospace.
Quite that many people. We're in the fact business here, Kenneth.
Is it not 30 million if you expand out to Riverside?
No, it's probably like LA County's 10, just under 10, and right. Orange County's 3.
All right,
yeah, so about 13 and a half.
If you expand out far enough, there's 30 million people.
Yeah, we're going to
Arizona.
If
you get San Francisco involved.
San Francisco, Arizona.
San Bernardino County is huge, by the way.
Right.
Yeah, goes all the way to Nevada.
Anyway, 30 million. Oh, we better change venues then. I overestimated. but whether or not anyone thinks it's a funny idea to try to build community in that space, I think that's the opportunity that we saw. Like Joey mentioned, not only our colleagues that spend their entire career traveling alone in cars and sitting in dark, depressing green rooms and being out on the road working for a living, not only trying to build a place for them to feel comfortable, but also, as Joey said, that really vibrant, great audience for which there's been great tracks laid in Southern California to participate in. So I guess they'll be the ones that help us decide if we'll do it again, but we're down.
We called it the first annual.
Yeah.
Which I was surprised that you were willing to say on the air.
I didn't say it.
I think you did in the intro.
I don't think so.
Oh, fact. I don't want to be
KCRW style guide.
I did say first annual.
Oh, the style guide is not going to like that.
Oh, no. I did say first annual.
But we did it intentionally because it's intentionally wrong, but it's also intentionally a little presumptuous.
Yeah.
And so it implies that
you want it to happen again.
We want,
And by the way, the Ford is an amazing venue. It is so intimate, right?
Yeah.
You're sort of there in the rocks, like there are like cliffs around you, right?
Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
You're there in the canyon.
Play us out, will you? Can you do something for us?
Of course.
Why are we standing still? We've got all of the time in the world to kill. We've got all of the time in the world to kill. The girls don't smile so free and so wild, but they go on smiling still. In a riot they are, every night's for the stars. They've got all of the time in the world to kill. We've got all of the time in the world to kill. The world must still be spinning. Forever stay in my arms this way. We've got all of the time in the world to kill. We've got all of the time in the world to kill. We've got all of the time in the world to kill.
Kenneth Pattingale, Joey Ryan, the Milk Carton Kids, their first annual, oh, I said it again, first annual L.A. Folk Festival happening over at the Ford Theater this weekend. Looks like the weather's going to be great for it, too, maybe cooling down a little bit after this heat wave.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to you both for coming in. And
thank you so
that
much.
That was wonderful.
What a pleasure.
We appreciate talking to you, Steve.
Moving on now with Greater L.A. from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Whether you love the iconic Swedish furniture giant IKEA or you hate it, you've probably spent some time traversing the big box labyrinth. It's where you go to grab a shelf and some kitchen towels for your new apartment, to chow down maybe on some surprisingly delicious meatballs. But could it also be the place to seek artistic inspiration? Well, that's the goal of a handful of artists participating in a new unofficial creative residency at the Big IKEA in Burbank. And the co-founder of that residency is named Mary Boo Anderson. And she's here to tell us more about it all. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for having me.
A residency at IKEA. So tell us a little bit about that and, you know, that it takes place inside the store. Is that what's going on?
Exactly. We can brag that we definitely have the biggest studio space in all of the U.S., I'm sure.
It is. I read that it is one of the biggest IKEA stores in the world, right?
It is. Number two.
Outside of Sweden?
Outside of Seoul, actually.
Seoul, yeah. South Korea.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
Yeah.
So the one in Burbank's number two. We're number two.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. So you're into, I mean, is it inspired by IKEA? What's going on there with the residency?
Exactly. So my co-founder and I, Zoe Blair Schlagenhoff, really thought IKEA was fertile grounds for making art, right? There's so much going on, either the new beginnings of a new home or maybe, you know, a bickering fight with a roommate or a loved one, or this idea of empowering yourself to make your own furniture. We thought it was kind of an interesting place to kind of make art. And so what we've been doing is we've been inviting artists, 14 at a time, to kind of meet up and make art. And how our parameters kind of work is we pair up our artists. So we ask you to meet up with a stranger, essentially another artist, in IKEA. And you can use this time to kind of critique each other's work or ideally kind of collaborate and make a work together inspired by IKEA.
I mean, what kind of crafts are we talking? Are we talking about canvas? Are we talking about, I mean, I would imagine there are some Allen wrenches involved, right?
Exactly. Some of those little Allen keys for sure. Our artists, we really take pride in that they run the gambit. We have painters, poets, we had a puppeteer. Our current session features a comedian and a chef among like interdisciplinary artists who work more in like installation or sculpture. We have some filmmakers, so wide variety.
Wide variety. Does IKEA know about this?
Not yet, Steve.
Wait, so you're doing a residency without the knowledge of the store in which you're doing the residency.
Exactly. Very guerrilla style. We embrace the DIY.
All right. So, I mean, obviously IKEA is not going to stop you as a customer from going in there, right? You just meet there and then take it from there?
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. Yep. The artists will meet up. And I feel like usually they do walk around the whole thing and kind of talk about their art and hopefully get inspired by, yeah, the weirdness of the showrooms or maybe specific objects or maybe that warehouse component. So many things to look at.
Are you going to tell them or they're going to listen? Maybe someone from IKEA is going to listen to this broadcast. I don't know. Maybe not.
Good question. I don't think we'll tell them, but if they find out, Zoe and I always like kind of joke that they're more likely to kind of invite us in than not. I feel like even if we're subverting the space of like consumerism, right, to hopefully create something a little more authentic, we are still kind of partaking in their space, right? And we're taking photos of things and we're bringing people there and we're having meals there. And I feel like maybe on some level they appreciate that.
And you've done this before.
Yeah, we just started. We're brand new, but we did a full session in summer and we're currently in our fall session. We already have selected our applicants for winter. And then hopefully we're going to have a spring session and then a spring exhibition that features all of the artwork that's been made in IKEA throughout the year.
Where will this exhibition be? Not at IKEA, because then you really have to tell them, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Although it would be funny to do it in like the as-is section or do some performances in the showrooms. But yeah, it'll be in an off-site gallery location.
And that exhibition will include like what kind of projects?
It'll include films people have made, paintings, books. Yeah, one artist, Jackie Tran, made this awesome zine where he interviewed visitors as well as employees in IKEA. So that was really cool. Robin Muniz and Caitlin Forrest have done a film series where they had people do dream reenactments in the domestic space of IKEA. So it'll be an interesting spring exhibition.
Did anyone use meatballs in the art?
Ooh, good question. I have not seen meatballs yet, but I hope so. Maybe I'll plant that in some people's brains. I think that's a wonderful idea.
Mary Boo Anderson, the co-founder of the IKEA Residency. And again, they don't know. Mary, thanks for coming on and talking with us about it. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Steve, for having me. Have a great day.
That's all the time we have for this evening. Next week, break-ins are happening a lot at pot shops these days, and store owners think the police aren't responding quickly because they don't see those businesses as fully legitimate. It's not your typical run club. We take you to the South Central Run Club, where it's focused on redefining wellness in the neighborhood. And will new changing criteria help more people get housed inside Mayor Karen Bass's Inside Safe program? All those stories and more next week on Greater LA. Check us out online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. And while you're there, tell us how you're doing, share a story idea, maybe even grab the podcast too so you can have us on the go. Or just search for podcasts wherever you get them at KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Ted Robbins, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, Eben Ray, and Christian Bordahl all helped put this evening's episode together. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the time. Thanks for that ear. Have a great night.